and welcome to the October edition of the Astropod. I'm Anna Quiter.
And I'm Maciek Hermanowicz. October means the public observing is back at the IOA. Every Wednesday from 6th of October onwards, meet us at 7 p.m. for an exciting talk and hopefully, if the weather is good, some go at the old telescopes on site.
So, Maciek, I heard you're giving one of the talks this month.
Yes, I will be giving a talk on the 13th of October. I will be talking about solar sailing.
Solar sailing. Oh, it sounds like a lot of fun.
Oh, I love the excitement in your voice. Basically, solar sailing is the use of sun's radiation to propel your spacecraft.
Oh, that really does sound awesome. Well, hey, if you're interested and you want to hear about solar sailing or any of the other topics we'll be talking about this month, you can go to our website, www.ast.cam.ac.uk/public, so you can find information about the talks and also maps and things like that for getting you to the Institute of Astronomy.
Yeah, and we hope to see you there.
So now, for those people who can't make it to your lecture, can you tell me some more about solar sailing?
As I've just said, the principle of operation of this type of propulsion is really very simple. And there's some Italian people who actually came up with a very neat application of that. They want to use solar sails to propel spacecraft. They call data clippers, as in the tea clippers of 19th century, the freight crafts which provided tea from India to the UK.
So these tea clippers and data clippers, they're just ships or vessels that can go around and collect things and drop them off at other places?
Yes, indeed. So the idea is essentially to get a large hard drive, send it to Jupiter on a very eccentric orbit, have it download all the information from a scientific probe which would be there, and then go back to Earth so that we can download it. The problem is you can't really transfer data over a long distance with so much accuracy. You just have to transfer things slower because it's easier to make a mistake.
Oh, because right now we use the Deep Space Network, don't we? The NASA Deep Space Network for contacting our space probes out there.
Yes, we do. But nowadays, the probes generate just so much data that you cannot possibly process it as it comes down live. So the idea would be you download the critical observations, but all the long time exposures and sort of very extended projects, they would wait for the freighter essentially to pick up the data and
how long would it take to get from Earth out to Jupiter and back using this mechanism for picking up our data?
It would be somewhere between half a year and a year, depending on the alignment of planets at the time of the transfer.
Oh, that's pretty awesome. It really sounds like our robotics and such things are really advancing.
Oh, yes. Basically, the technology is not quite there yet, but it should be there in about a year or two.
Look forward to hearing more about it.
Indeed. And to hear more about exciting astro stuff, here's Laura with the news.
Hi, I'm Laura, and welcome to this month's Astro News. Herschel Telescope discovers water vapor close to CW Leonis. The star CW Leonis, located around 500 light years from the solar system, was shown to possess a shroud of water vapor by the submillimeter wave astronomy satellite in 2001. This water was believed to come from comets, or planets destroyed by the expansion of the star as it aged. The alternative, that the water came from the material in the stellar wind, was dismissed. As an old red giant, CW Leonis is producing large amounts of carbon from helium burning in its core. Its wind must therefore contain lots of carbon, which would inevitably react with any free oxygen to form carbon monoxide. This means that there's no oxygen left to bond with hydrogen and form water. However, recent observations with Herschel, the European Space Agency's Long Wavelength Space Telescope, have revealed that the water vapour is present very close to the star, all the way down to the surface. This means that the water must be formed in the stellar wind. One possibility is that UV radiation from nearby large hot stars is breaking apart the carbon monoxide, releasing the oxygen and allowing it to react with the hydrogen to form water. The thick, dusty stellar wind from old stars should be preventing the UV radiation from getting very near to the star, but it must occasionally penetrate this dust shroud, implying that the wind is clumpy or sporadic. Successful test of NASA's new booster rocket. NASA recently tested the giant 5-stage booster rocket that will power the early flight stages of its next big rocket. The test took place in Utah at a facility owned by the manufacturers ATK and achieved 16,000 kilonewtons of thrust. The current four-stage system used on the shuttle delivers 1,000 times less thrust. The ATK booster was originally commissioned as part of the Constellation program, a multi-billion dollar project to allow NASA to return to the moon. Since the cancellation of the project, it's been unclear what form, if any, the next big NASA rocket will take. In February, President Obama told NASA to investigate new technologies before designing a next-generation rocket. Lightning on Earth and Venus strikingly similar. Although Venus has a very different atmosphere to Earth, scientists have discovered that lightning is produced through very similar mechanisms. The rates of discharge, intensity of the lightning, and the pattern seen in where it strikes show startling similarities. This gives a new insight into the chemistry, dynamics, and evolution of the atmosphere of the two planets. Lightning on Venus was first hinted at by the Pioneer Venus orbiter, and more recently by the Galileo spacecraft, which saw flashes in the Venusian heavens. But as Venus's atmosphere has such a different composition and chemistry to Earth's, scientists weren't sure that it was lightning they were seeing, until Venus Express's magnetometer studied it in detail. Dr. Russell at the University of California, which analyzed the data, said that Venus and Earth are often called twin planets because of their similar size, mass, and interior structure. The generation of lightning is one more way in which Venus and Earth are fraternal twins. That's all for this month's Astro News.
Thank you very much, Laura.
So, Magic, I've been reading an article lately about using supercomputers in modeling. Then this is kind of interesting because we were talking earlier about how technology has really been advancing in things. And one of the places we can really see that is in supercomputers and our ability to do computation.
Yes, it is true. The technology is, and the processing power is advancing in quite a rapid state. And I've heard from some of my friends doing star formation that nowadays we are able to model a star very accurately, evolving in real time.
That's amazing. Well, I've just read an article about our solar system and being able to model dust in our solar system as it may have looked over the past, you know, millions of years.
Oh, so basically we could tell what any extraterrestrial intelligent life could see if they turned their supposed telescopes on our sun.
Yeah, so it's really cool. NASA's Discover supercomputer has actually just kept track of 75,000 dust particles from the Kuiper Belt. And it's tracked what happens to them as they interact with the planets and with the solar wind, as you mentioned earlier, and interact with each other. And from looking at this, they've been able to predict how the dust will be glowing and how the dust will be moving around. And this is pretty awesome because when we look at other stars and look at other solar systems outside of our solar system, one of the big things that we see are glowing dust rings.
Actually makes you wonder if there's anyone out there watching us. And I believe it's time for your history section now.
As this month's interviewee has spent time at the European Southern Observatory, known as ESO, this month's history section is a brief overview of ESO's history. As its name suggests, ESO is Europe's major facility for observing the night sky in the Southern Hemisphere. The idea for a shared European telescope facility began in 1953, but it took about 10 years to formally establish ESO. The first member nations were Belgium, Germany, France, the Netherlands, and Sweden. The UK joined in 2002, and there are 14 member states today. La Silla Mountain in Chile, South America, was chosen as the first observing site. It is ideal because it is one of the driest and darkest areas of the Earth. Observations started in 1966 with the first telescope, called the ESO 1-meter telescope. Today, the La Silla site is home to 3 ESO-run telescopes, 6 member state-run telescopes, and 12 decommissioned telescopes. Over the past 40 years, ESO has expanded beyond La Silla to 2 other observing sites, Chanantor and Paranal, both in Chile. The Chanantor site is home to ALMA, the Atacama Large Millimeter-Submillimeter Array. This telescope is a network of 66 antennae spread over distances from 150 meters to a whopping 16 kilometers, making it one of the largest astronomical projects today. ALMA observes light with a wavelength between infrared light and radio waves, allowing it to see very cold objects in the universe. It should begin operation in 2011. The flagship ESO facility is the Very Large Telescope, a group of 4 telescopes at Paranal, each having a primary mirror of 8.2 meters in diameter. The decision to build the VLT was made in 1987. It then took 3 years to select Paranal as the telescope site, and all 4 VLT telescopes were operational by 2000, which is over a decade after inception. ESO is currently working on the next generation of giant telescopes, the European Extremely Large Telescope.
This telescope will have a mirror that is 42 meters in diameter, making it able to collect over 15 times more light than the largest optical telescopes in operation today. Planning for this telescope began in 2006, and a site near Paranal was chosen in 2010 to be the home of this telescope. ESO hopes that it will begin operation in 2018.
Our guest this month is Dr. Mark Kilas, who joined us at the Institute of Astronomy in March this year. Hello.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Your career with astronomy started off with a PhD in Utrecht, and then you spent a few years down in Chile at the European Southern Observatory. Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
So I imagine you're quite a good person to talk to about the different phases of research that astronomers carry out among the globe. Which one would you say you prefer?
That's a difficult question to start with directly. So in Chile, I worked for the European Southern Observatory, which is the largest European organization based there in Chile. And they have two astronomical sites, and I was based in Paranal, which is in the north of Chile. And what we do there, what the people that work there, the scientists, they spend their free time when they're not observing in the office doing science. And then they have a fixed time in their contract that they have to spend and work for the observatory. So that's in the desert up on the mountain. And both was a fantastic experience, but after 3 years I realized that from doing science I get more energy, and from observing I get less energy on average. It's tiring. You have to work at night, the shifts are very long, they can be very stressful. So as an experience, I would say it's something I would like to have missed, but for the long term, I think doing investigations in a kind of office-based environment is what I would prefer.
Throughout your career, your research was focusing mostly on the questions about star clusters. Could you tell us more about that?
Yes, I started my PhD working in Utrecht in a group where they worked on observations of star clusters. And very quickly in the first year, I realized I would like to understand also a bit of the underlying theory. So I have tried to do a bit of observations and theoretical research on this. And then in my first postdoc in Chile, I of course focused more on observational work, because that was just the environment was much more suitable for that. But near the end, I realized it's more fun actually to dig into the problems of stellar dynamics in the cores of dense stellar clusters. A lot of interesting thing happened there, and I would like to learn more and work more on that.
Can you tell our listeners what is so interesting about those systems? Why do we want to understand them?
So it's a strange mind twist that you have to make to understand why they're so interesting. So the example I like to give is always the comparison with the moon and the Earth. If you think of the moon and the Earth as two molecules in a gas that are in equilibrium and they're in motion due to their gravity in a stable configuration, then what a gas would do if you would slow down one of the components is that it would actually move slower. Whereas the moon and the Earth, if you would slow down the moon, it will move a bit closer to the Earth, and then it speeds up, and then you have essentially heated the system. And this is due to the energy of gravitational systems, and they are negative. So galaxies have this as well, and star clusters have this as well. But star clusters are small enough, that the number of stars are small enough, such that you can see the result of that. So over the time of the age of the universe, you can see that star clusters have evolved due to this interesting aspect of gravitational systems, this negative energy. So this is theoretically very challenging to understand. It's relatively easy if you assume very simple boundary conditions. So you say that there's no galaxy, there's just a star cluster, and then all the stars have the same mass, and there's no stellar evolution, so these stars have the same mass throughout the age of the universe, and that's all very easy. But once you start to add more realistic aspects, like binary stars, for example, or explosions of stars, or there's a parent galaxy and the cluster moves through the galaxy, then it starts to be more complicated, and that's what I'm fascinated in. There's a kind of underlying simple principle that determines the evolution, and to what extent this still holds if you add realistic aspects is what I'm interested in.
Part of your work was focusing on the question of how easy it is for those systems to survive.
Right, yeah. A direct result of this evolution is that they lose stars. So constantly there are stars that are being pushed from the inner sides to the outer side, so they gain energy through interactions with other stars. So they, let's say, they move relatively slow in the inner parts and they start being accelerated. At some point they reach an energy that's enough to leave the system, and they become basically a field star in the galaxy that is not associated with the cluster. And this happens in different speeds. It can go really fast if you're in the center of a galaxy, for example, and the tidal forces because of the galaxy are so strong that it's very easy to strip apart a star cluster, whereas if you're far out in the outer parts, what's called the halo of the galaxy, there it's, you can survive easy for the age of the universe.
Is it believed that most of the stars originate in star clusters?
That's at the moment a very active debate. It's one of these things you read very often in people that apply for grants or for observing time, or when they write papers even, they say all stars form in clusters. Because if you look at young stars, they seem to be more grouped together. But it's very hard to come up with a sound definition of what is a star cluster at these young ages, because they look not round like old star clusters. They look spherical and they seem to be relaxed in a dynamical sense. But very young systems are messy. There's stars everywhere and they're connected with filaments or lines, and there's blobs here and blobs there, and we don't really know if they will merge to a larger one or they will just spread out in the field. So some people would say all the stars form in star clusters, and others would say it's just a few percent. Because if we look at old stars, only a few of them are actually part of a star cluster.
To finish off this interview, can I just ask you, what pushed you to do astronomy in the first place?
That's a good one. I think it's not the typical amateur astronomy path that most people have. I wasn't really thinking about this when I was doing high school, but when I had to make a decision for university, that's I think how I felt this in this last year of high school. I have to make a decision. And then somebody came up with this and I thought, really, you can do that? And I went to an open day, like an information day of the university, and I thought, that sounds really interesting. And that's basically last minute decision in the last year of high school.
I see. Thank you very much. It was a great pleasure to have you as our guest this month. Goodbye.
Bye. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark and Magic. So, hey, Magic, have you read anything interesting lately?
Oh, yes. I found a story about a star cannibal.
Cannibal star?
Yes. There's this star called BP Piscium, which is believed to be quite a young object just after having been formed, because it was surrounded by a nice accretion disk and had some jets flowing out of it. But turns out there's more to it.
Really? Like, what do you mean?
They had some recent observations done with the X-ray Chandra telescope, and it turns out it's not hot enough to be a young star. So what they believe it is, it's actually a very old, evolved object, which cannibalized its binary partner, the smaller star, which was orbiting it, and that sort of made the original star a bit more vigorous after a tasty meal.
So how common is stellar cannibalism?
It's really hard to say. At the moment, we only have a vague estimate of how many stars actually have binary companions, and then we know that some of them will merge eventually, but what the actual rate is not that easy to predict. So every system we discover like that is actually quite a good thing to have around and observe further.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like quite a complicated system to disentangle.
I bet it is.
Well, hey, let's go to Alex at the Sky at Night and see if he can tell us about anything else cool that's up this month.
Up in the skies this month, the Orionid meteor shower graces our skies on the 21st of October. Whilst the meteors will seem to radiate from the highly recognizable Orion constellation, hence the name, in the southeast of the sky after dark, the moon is almost full, and so only the very brightest meteors will be seen. Consequently, expect to see only 10 to 15 meteors an hour. Meteor showers occur when the Earth passes through the dust trail of a comet, and these meteors come from one of the most famous, Halley's Comet. Another comet providing interesting viewing this month is the comet Hartley 2. Discovered in 1986, this year's approach of 18 million kilometres, 11 million miles, will be the closest to the Earth since its discovery, and in fact the closest approach of any comet for the last few centuries. Due to its proximity, it will be visible through binoculars and fly through a large number of constellations throughout the month. During the first week of October, it lies below the W shape of Cassiopeia, before then moving across through the head of Perseus. The closest approach is on October 20th, when it lies just below the bright star Capella in Auriga, before finishing the month in Gemini. During November, it dims rapidly, although on November 6th, The NASA spacecraft, Epoxy, will pass within 1,000 kilometers, 600 miles, of the nucleus of this comet, photographing this icy relic from the beginnings of the solar system. If you missed Mercury last month, then you get chance for a small reprise at the very beginning of this month. You can find it in the pre-dawn sky, about 5 to 10 degrees above the horizon from the 1st to the 5th, but it's not as good an apparition as happened last month and quickly disappears in the sun's glow for the rest of the month. As mentioned last month, always observe Mercury whilst the sun is still below the horizon, especially if using binoculars or telescopes. Early October sees the variable star Myra reach maximum brightness in the constellation Cetus in the east-southeast after sunset. This star periodically brightens and dims every 332 days, and there is an entire class of variable stars with about 6,000 members named after it. Over the course of the cycle, the brightness increases by a factor of about 150, and even though for most of the cycle it can only be seen with binoculars and telescopes, at its peak, it will be during this month, it is bright enough to be seen unaided. Finally, Jupiter is still brightly dominating the southeastern sky in late evening. It is about 4% brighter than normal, as the lack of one of its equatorial belts means it is whiter and so reflects more light. Its closeness to Earth means it's still a good target for modest-sized telescopes to make out lots of detail in the cloud structure, including that most famous of storms, the Great Red Spot. And that's it for the sky at night this month. Now back to Anna and Maciek.
Thank you very much, Alex. So I've been told you found out something about beer in space.
Oh yeah, that's right. It turns out that there's an Australian beer that has been brewed for easy drinking in the microgravity environment.
Oh, I love the PR.
Yeah, I know. It's awesome, isn't it? So it turns out that Zero Gravity Corporation has a modified Boeing aircraft, which will fly you up and let you feel like you're weightless for a few minutes. And they're going to take test people. I don't know if they're astronauts or not, but they're going to have testers who go up in this flight and drink this specially brewed beer, and then they're going to test them for like lightheadedness and their blood alcohol content and that sort of thing to see how well people handle drinking beer in a low gravity environment.
That sounds like quite an interesting research, and I believe they had quite an easy time finding volunteers for that.
Yeah, I'm certain that they did. The cool thing about this, though, is that it really shows that the age of space tourism is upon us.
Oh, yes. Next time, you know, you might even get a free drink in price of your $50 million spaceflight.
Continuing with this lighter note in the program, on to Michelle with the joke this month.
Hello, Maciek.
Hello, Michelle.
Are you ready for another stellar joke of the month?
Of course I am.
Brilliant. Drum roll, please. Why is space a vacuum?
I don't know. Why is space a vacuum?
How else are you going to clean up all the stardust?
That's a good one.
Yes.
That's a really good one. I like it.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you, and don't forget to tune in next month.